Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Louise Penny's New York Times bestselling and critically revered mystery series has been synonymous with the words elegance, depth, and empathy since her mystery debut, Still Life, 7 years ago. Now the wise and beleaguered Chief Inspector Armand Gamache faces his nemesis and uncovers shattering revelations in How the Light Gets In. The book has already hit number one on the Times bestsellers list, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Louise Penny to The Book Show. Thank you so much for being here.
Well, it's a great pleasure to be here. Thank you.
I love when you are here and love to talk about your work.
And what was that you were saying about the New York Times list? I didn't quite catch that.
So the book comes out, boom, you go up to number one. You dethrone J.K. Rowling, of all people.
Yes.
How exciting.
I can barely even speak about it. I am so excited. I was in Houston in the middle of the book tour, and my publicist from Minotaur Books came down to Houston, and we were sitting around, and we got the news, and we shrieked and shrieked. Then I burst into tears. I mean, I was, and she was rubbing my back, and I was in tears because it's the sort of thing every author that I know of dreams of, because authors were readers first. What do we read? We read, among other things, the New York Times bestseller list. And so the thought of actually ever being on it, never mind the top of it, genuinely was inconceivable. To know that it has happened was just overwhelming and remains overwhelming. I'm having difficulty even now expressing how it feels.
The other thing I think that is so remarkable and wonderful about your story is that, I mean, all you've been writing for a long time, but this series is, what, seven?
This is the ninth book.
Okay. So how many years have you been writing this series?
Probably about 10 or 11, because it took a few years, of course, to write the first book.
Sure.
And then to find a publisher and whatnot. And then after that, I tell people, it took 45 years, really, to write the first one. And then they wanted a book a year after that. It's been just slightly over 10 years. But I'm 55 now, so I was well into my 40s by the time I started Still Life, the first book.
What do you think it is about the work, and I'm sure you've thought of this, although it's probably hard to put into words, of what it is about the character, what it is about the series that brings an audience in a very crowded marketplace of detective stories?
To be honest, I don't really know. I think they're unusual because there's really not a body count. They're crime fiction, they're murder mysteries, and I feel quite benevolent in saying that there's only one murder. Because we only need one murder.
Right. One's enough. That's
One's
good.
One's enough, exactly. But they're not about murder. They're about life. They're about choices. They're about belonging and community. And they're inspired by a whole lot of things. But one thing was Virginia Woolf's book Orlando. And at the beginning of Orlando, the first line or two of Orlando, and I'm going to just paraphrase, but Orlando is a character who's lived many lifetimes and many guys, as many male, female, whatever. The beginning of the book is through all the lifetimes, through all the years, Orlando was only looking for one thing, and it wasn't power, and it wasn't money, it wasn't even love. All Orlando wanted was company. I understood that at my heart, because I grew up a lonely child, self-excluding, nobody excluded me, but I, for whatever reason, always felt on the island looking at the mainland, both yearning to be a part of the mainland and terrified to be part of it. And so I understood that yearning for company. And so that's really at the heart of a lot of what I write is, what do we want as human beings? We want company. We want a sense of belonging. We want to feel safe and secure and loved, friendship. And that's really, it's about goodness, the fact that goodness really does exist.
I think of this as almost a county fair idea, which is that you go to your county fair, but you don't really feel like you're part of that county, like you're a visitor. Oh. And then all of a sudden you find a place where you feel like you're a part of it.
Isn't that magical? Isn't
Yes.
that the most amazing feeling in the world? I think a lot of us go through a lot of our lives looking for that community where there's an empty chair that's just waiting for you and always has been. And you sit down and you say, this is where I belong.
So to expand on that, to bring it to a character and to bring it to a series of books where we can go into that world and feel like we have a place to sit down. Do you think that the setting has something to do with that?
I think it has a lot to do with that. For me, setting is character, but I'm not unusual in that.
Right.
That's common, obviously, in books and particularly in crime novels. My setting is the small village of Three Pines, which is just north of the Vermont border. And it is meant to be. There's an element of magical realism about it, and I wanted to bring that almost hyper-ideal sense that it is excruciatingly pretty. It's in a little valley. It's not on any map. It's only really ever found because it's so far off the beaten track that it's only ever found by people lost, and that it kind of magically appears without it being. I don't want to make it sound like it's fantasy. It's not fantasy. It's just a village that happens to be there, and there are a lot of them in Quebec's eastern townships where you're driving along some dirt road and there's a village. And so there is that magical realism. It's hyper ideal. It's very pretty. It's got a bookstore and a bistro and a bakery and all the things that we would want. In fact, the first thing that I created in this village was the bookstore.
And it's such a texture to the series and this book in particular that goes, I think, beyond a traditional mystery novel.
You.
There is a depth, which, of course, comes from that setting and what we know of this wonderful character.
I think there's a reason it took me 45 years to write the first book. And I look back on my life and I realize that I've tried to write a book every decade of my life until my 40s. Probably not the first decade. I must give myself a pass there. Although I did realize I wanted to be a writer when I was 8, but I don't think I actually started in on the full-length novel at the time. But the reason I think the earlier ones, I got like 3 chapters in and just gave up, was because I was kind of callow. I was very fortunate in my life. I was raised with a lot of privilege. I was raised without any acrimony, with a lot of love, but I never understood how lucky I really was. So I took a lot of that for granted, and I sort of traipsed through life. And there's a line. A lot of my stuff is inspired by poetry, and there's a line from Auden's Elegy to Yeats where he said that mad Ireland hurt him into poetry, and that resonated with me because I think I had to be hurt into writing as well. I think I had to get a certain number of blows in my life so that and hit a number of those forks in the road where I could either become embittered or compassionate, where I could either go to the dark or go to the light. And I think I really had to be hurt into it.
I remember Kurt Vonnegut telling me that you have to have life slap you around a little bit before you can really write.
I did. I think there are some people who are remarkable who write really transcendent works when they are 19. I really genuinely was not one of them. And I'm happy about that, because when this kind of success, which is really ridiculously wonderful, happens, I am really aware of how lucky I am. There isn't a day when I don't wake up and genuinely count my blessings.
The thing I love about Three Pines is that it seems as though real life is just that much away and it's creeping closer.
Mm-hmm.
But there's still the insular, wonderful feeling of that place. Is keeping real life away a challenge in the writing at all?
It's interesting you say that, because I don't see that myself as real life, because I live in a village that is actually quite similar to that. There's a lot of kindness, but there's also cruelty.
Right. But when murder comes, it's an aberration.
Oh, for sure. Oh, absolutely. It's an aberration. Unlike, I lived and worked many years in Montreal, where murder is in the briefs section of the newspaper. And a murder in downtown Montreal will always be a tragedy, but it's not the violation of a community that it is when the community is so beautiful and so idyllic and in many ways so innocent. And that's why, the books are about duality, about the pastoral setting, about the decent human beings, not perfect, but they're decent human, like all of us. That's the thing that I learned. When I was on my island looking at the mainland, I was on the island by choice eventually because I was afraid that the mainland was populated by unkind people. It took me a long time to realize they're me. They're not no more unkind than I am. And so I am safe on the mainland. I'm safer on the mainland than on my island, slowly dying of loneliness. And that's what I discovered. And that's what I wanted to bring to Three Pines, is that these people aren't aliens. They're no more good. They're no more bad than any of us. They have both inside them. They're, again, sorry to keep quoting, but the Auden poem, again, I love Auden, where he talks about that evil is unspectacular and always human. And we are introduced to goodness every day among a crowd of faults. And that's in my books, evil is unspectacular and always human and sits at our table. And we are introduced to goodness among a crowd of faults. And that's even the good people, of course, have faults.
But you don't want to see those good people undone by the evil.
No.
And we worry about that when we, that's, I think, the wonderful thing about reading the book is that you worry about that.
Yeah.
You don't want that to happen.
I like that. I love that. And it's a bit of a, I don't want to say double-edged sword, because it really isn't that. But as the series has gone on, people, of course, have invested more and more into the characters and into Three Pines. And so there is that. I get a lot of quite upset emails from people who are wondering, how is Gamash, the detective, or how is so-and-so, or how's Ruth, the demented poet, or Rosa, or whatever. And, you know, don't do this, or don't you dare do that, or how could you do this? But that's the other thing that I try. That's why they really aren't traditional. These aren't traditional books. They are in the guise of traditional books, but they aren't murder mysteries. And that's that, as you know, because you've read the whole series, that there's no character who's sacrosanct. They're all vulnerable, just as we are. None of them is covered in an invincibility robe. They can be physically damaged. They can be emotionally damaged. They can be killed. They can disappear, just like in real life.
Louise Penny is our guest. The new novel is How the Light Gets In. As you mentioned, I've read the series, and I'm curious as to whether you find this to be a true statement or not. It seems like maybe third, fourth book in, you really found your voice.
I think that's probably true, although a big part of me is going, well, I was great all the way. How dare you? My children is perfect.
Of course.
Of course. You're such a nice guy.
Well, I mean, that would be the natural, you put the blood, sweat, and tears. And the first book has to be special because it got published and was out. And
there's something amazing about a first book.
Sure.
It's just, I will love Still Life forever. But I think you're probably right. I think what happened was I found my voice. Fear has been a big thing in my life. I'm just riddled with fear, less so now, but still, and certainly growing up. So I think when the first book came out, I was very afraid of not being able to do it again because it seemed magical. It seemed as though I was really unclear how it happened. It was something I'd wanted all my life and being unable to do. And then finally I worked and I worked and I worked over the course of years. And it happened, then it got published, and it was well received. Then I had to produce a second novel, and I was genuinely paralyzed with fear that I was being offered everything I have ever dreamed of, and that I wouldn't be able to do it. And I think it took a few books for me to realize I can do it. You know, I want every book to be better than the last, and I have a certain confidence that I can at least produce a book. That's no longer a fear. I know I can. The fear remains, will it be as good as the last? Because I want it to be even better than I want there to be growth for me as a writer. Because that's what makes it interesting for me. I don't want to write the same book over and over again. Because why would I? Frankly, I'm 55. I live in the middle of the country. You know, the main currency is turnips. So, you know, I don't need a lot of money. I will never, ever, ever be writing for the money. So I don't need to write for the market. I write what I love. I write books I would read. And people are welcome to come along on the parade. So I'm less fearful now.
So you have enough people on the parade route that they brought the book to number one in the New York Times bestseller list.
Can you believe it?
That's lovely. And you think to yourself, okay, I don't care about the money. I don't care about the market. And yet when you, but does it restore some faith that you have that group behind you that are reading the type of book that you like and that you produce.
That's a wonderful way of putting it. And I don't want anyone to think that I don't care, you know, in terms of the market and the money,
sure,
and whatnot. But I'm very competitive. I want to be number one.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And it is an amazing feeling to know that I'm not alone. As someone, again, who's a lonely child on the island, grew into a lonely, it's less lonely, but still somewhat isolated adolescent and so on, to really seriously have the sense that I'm not alone, that I'm not alone in ways that really count, that other people share the love of what I love too, that my idea of friends is the same, my idea of belonging, my idea of goodness, and that kindness is a currency that really needs to be valued in this life, that calling someone nice should not be the insult that today it seems to be. These are unfashionable values, but I don't understand who gets to decide what's fashionable anymore, because it seems to me those are the values that I now live by, didn't always, but that I try to live by. I choose my company very carefully now because I can be quite easily influenced. And I choose to be around kind people, good people. I would choose kindness over cleverness any day now. And it is a wonderful validation to realize that I'm not alone in that, that everyone in the parade with me feels the same way. And I think that there is a yearning out there for the validation that goodness exists. It exists in each of us. It exists in the society.
I have had mystery writers tell me before that the death term is cozy.
Mm-hmm.
Do you embrace cozy?
No, I don't. No. I did at first before I realized that it was actually a bullet. cozy is code. Cozy is code for superficial. I'm not sure, you know, it's not that you or I would use it like that, but I have come to understand that that is what is meant by cozy. And
but it's much like you were saying about being nice, being, you know,
well, if it wasn't code for superficial, I would be happy to be cozy. Except my books, I don't think my books are cozy. I think that there is an underlying... I think of my books as not about blood, obviously, but really about the marrow, about the terror that each of us feels. And there are different levels at which you can read the books intellectually, or you can read them with the rest of your body, you know, with your soul, with your spirit, with your heart. And I think if you do that, then you don't necessarily feel that they're so cozy. I really do think of them as... And I can appreciate that some people may not agree, but as psychological thrillers, they're a lot, they're kind of Hitchcock-esque for me. Hitchcock didn't have much blood, didn't have a big body count, but there was that great sense of growing kind of dread, of tension, of something at stake. And that's what I wanted to do, was create a village, create it as someplace that you want to be, and then have it threatened. And see what happens to good people when they are so under threat, like all of us. Is it situational ethics, or do you really stand up? Can you stand up for what you believe in, or is it cardboard?
And I guess cozy goes out the window when, by page 5, you have Ruth yelling at another character, "Get your own duck." It's one of my favorite lines in the book.
Yeah, cozy is, and traditional even. I mean, these are all, I think, ways that books can be dismissed by people who don't want to be overtly unkind, but that is are unkind. It kind of amazes me that within the genre of crime fiction, and this is something I've come to, I didn't realize this, I covered Hard News and Current Affairs. I write these books as psychological thrillers. It never occurred to me that they were cozies or even that they were traditional. They are simply a look at the world that I live in and the fact that evil is unspectacular and always human, but it exists. In Three Pines, don't be fooled by the beautiful exterior. The books are about duality, the beautiful exterior and what's really happening behind the closed doors. The facade that we all have, the smiling courtesy that we all bring, thank God, to our interactions, but which is really at odds with what we're actually thinking about the person. The gap between what we say and how we feel. that's what the books are about. And I think if people see the books as traditional or as cozies, then I think they're only looking at the facade and they're not looking at the gap and what's in the hole.
You've mentioned loneliness a couple of times, and I'm curious as to whether that there was a point where, in being a journalist, in being a writer, you're still that person in a room writing.
Now, that's been the change as the books have gone on. Was it for the first few books, I really felt deeply connected to the crime writing community and to the community around me because it really fed me with all sorts of ideas. I found myself sitting in bistros and restaurants, mm-hmm. listening to conversations, picking up on what people were saying. So I felt really connected. But with the passage of time, while I'm still doing that, I'm appreciating really how very isolating, at least for me, writing is. It takes me a year and a half, although I have a book out every year. I start thinking about a book for 6 months before I start writing. It takes me about a year to write. And in that time, when I'm writing, I write in the morning, and then I don't want to see anyone all day because I'm thinking about the book. Then I go to bed, wake up the next morning, and I write. It's a price that I've had to pay, and it's one I've paid willingly and joyously, but I've really had to step back from my community, from my friends, from my family even, and it has become more and more isolating. But I no longer feel on the island because I truly understand that this is a choice, that they are actually... I have great friends and a great community, and they are sitting outside the door just waiting for me, that it's my choice, it's not theirs.
Mm-hmm. You have quoted poetry a few times throughout our conversation. The title of the book comes from a lyric.
Yes. Yes, Leonard Cohen, another Canadian, another Montrealer.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually initially from a poem that he turned into a lyric for the song Anthem, as you know. And that I will sing it. Him. See the look on your face. Oh. Another F word.
I get very excited when our guests read and sing. I love both of them.
No, I'm actually not going to sing because even Durant. You know, Leonard Cohen is clearly not famous for his voice, but even I would massacre. I would make him sound like a great singer. But I will recite it. Him, are you ready? Because it's going to be thrilling. Ring the bells that still can ring. Forget your perfect offering. There's a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in. One of the reasons I was fearful was that I was afraid of the judgment of others. I was afraid of the imperfect offering, mm-hmm. of me being imperfect, of things that I do being imperfect. I was afraid of criticism. And that became a really quite an anvil to lug around, and it clearly was standing between me and allowing me to achieve what I wanted to achieve. So to read that poem, or that I actually read the lyrics before I heard the song, it really had a deep, deep impact on me. Not only an invitation to be imperfect, but the knowledge that you have to be if you're going to let the light in, that the light comes through the imperfections. And that was very, very freeing for me. And so that's for me really interesting to explore in this book, but it also goes through, it's a theme. That's a quote that I used actually in the second book.
Mm.
And it's a theme that goes through all of the books, is that this is about quietly shattering lives, how the light gets in, but sometimes it also allows the dark out.
Which is a beautiful way of thinking about that, even though it is a crack, it's there for a reason. We need it in some way.
It is a blessing. And I know in my own life, it goes back to what we were saying before. I had to be hurt into poetry. I had to be hurt into writing. If I hadn't been shattered a few times in my life, I would not have started Still Life and continued and have, I don't want to say that I have, you know, I have certainly not experienced half the pain that most people have, but I have enough to draw on that it has allowed me to connect in a real way, and not just sort of sitting in a restaurant connecting with the rest of the world, but at a really human level, to feel compassion, to feel empathy for other people, to not necessarily understand what they themselves are going through, but to not be as judgmental or as cynical as I once was, to drop the walls.
Louise Penny's new novel is How the Light Gets In. It's published by St. Martin's Minotaur. Louise Penny, it's a great pleasure and a thrill to have you here. Thank you so much for spending time with us.
Joe, thank you.
We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the show. You can email us at book@wamc.org. And you can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.